This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening and welcome to The Informer. Dean Beck with you this evening. Scientists have announced an end to AIDS as a public health issue here in Australia. What does that mean? And what does it mean for you and me? We'll find out tonight on The Informer. Over the weekend just gone, five of Australia's organisations that deal with HIV and AIDS have got together and announced the end of AIDS in Australia. Well, one of those organisations is the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations. Its executive director is Darryl O'Donnell. He joins us on The Informer. Welcome, Darryl.
Thanks, Dean.
The end of AIDS, it's a big statement. Can you clarify what that really means for us?
Yeah, look, it is, and it's actually something quite exciting for those of us who have lived through the horror of HIV and AIDS in Australia to have reached a point where people who are diagnosed early, people and can access the benefits of treatment, where we can prevent AIDS illness, where we can prevent death. It's an amazing place for us to be. And this announcement is really about saying that with the possibilities of early detection and the power of effective treatment, that the mass illness and death that we saw in the 80s and 90s has passed.
That doesn't mean that people with HIV can't progress to AIDS, though, does it?
It doesn't. It doesn't at all. It means that diagnosis, early diagnosis, is more important than ever. Mm-hmm. It means that we've got the power through treatment to actually keep people well. And a person who's diagnosed early with HIV can actually expect to live a long and healthy and full life. But the trick is we've got to get to them early. And so a person who has HIV but doesn't know that they have HIV is a terrible thing. And we really need to be making HIV testing. As widely available, as accessible as possible.
And we see over 1,000 cases each year diagnosed of HIV, and of those, roughly 25% are late diagnosis, at least 3 or 4 or 5 years.
That's right. So we've got to get that. Period of time between when a person acquires HIV and when they get diagnosed. We've got to get that much, much closer to the point when they're acquiring HIV. Because we know from the START study, just in the last 18 months, 2 years or so, we now know that treatment is beneficial at all stages of HIV. And that's relatively new. So even though we've had pretty powerful HIV treatments now for 20 years, we haven't known until the last couple of years that treatment is always good, that it is always beneficial clinically for the individual for them to be treating. Now, there are some reasons why a person may not be able to treat at a particular time in their life, but we do know that it is always beneficial and a person knowing that they have HIV will always benefit from being able to treat if they can get that, if they have that knowledge of their HIV infection very early.
We're still dealing with the AZT hangover, though, aren't we? There's still stigma associated with treatment, and that stops people from accessing it early.
Look, there's huge stigma, and this is one of the big challenges, and it's really part of the story. There's no easy version of this story because, in the public's mind, HIV and AIDS can still be overly linked. They can be interchangeable. Not everyone understands the distinction between the two. But until we actually blast through these old understandings of the epidemic, we can't tackle the stigma that lies at the heart of people's experience, and a lot of that stigma comes from, the terror, the absolute terror that was experienced in the 80s and in the early 90s with the spectre of the epidemic. And trying to tell a new story of HIV, a new and a modern and a contemporary version of the epidemic, that it is different now, is part of trying to reduce the stigma that still attaches itself to HIV because of these legacy notions of illness and death that come from an earlier time in the epidemic.
In more recent times, the HIV landscape has changed dramatically with Australia now approving and being able to access PrEP. Still not quite there yet, to my liking, its availability, but that has the potential to really change things in the very near future, does it not?
This is the other huge transformation that, you know, we've spent 35 years now with condoms, and you know, condoms have been the mainstay of HIV prevention. A couple of years ago, we started to learn a lot more about just how powerfully effective HIV treatment is in preventing a person with HIV from being able to pass on HIV to others. And now we've got this, you know, PrEP, as you say, once a day pill that for people at risk of acquiring HIV sexually, you know, is incredibly effective in preventing HIV. But we're not there yet. We don't have the kind of access we need. You know, in Victoria, in a couple of weeks' time, with, you know, the PrEPEX study will launch, and the interest in that has been phenomenal. In New South Wales, there's been extraordinary uptake in the EPIC trial. Queensland's rolling out a huge trial. ACT's just announced a big trial, and a lot of people are still personally importing PrEP from overseas generic versions of Truvada. But until the PBS, until the Australian government actually subsidises Truvada. Under the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, and it can be accessed in the way that we access anything else through our doctor and our local chemist, we've got barriers to people being able to get it.
I went to the Kirby Institute's briefing of the seroconversion study last night, and it was fascinating to see the data of individuals who have seroconverted in the last 2 years and just how that compares to the types of people that are accessing PrEP. And in the whole, it suggests that those who think they are most at risk are putting themselves forward and are going on PrEP, which is to be encouraged and is fantastic. But I'm seeing a new emergence of stigma against people who have recently been diagnosed HIV positive because they weren't on PrEP. Have you heard of these things?
That's a pretty new one, but you know, this is the evolution of the epidemic, isn't it? But you know, to your original point, Dean, you know, that's so right. You know, this, one of the terrible things that we've experienced in Australia is a set of lies told about gay men, and the lie that I think has been most destructive and most hurtful for many of us has been the lie of complacency, and that's not a part of my experience of the epidemic, my experience of any time the epidemic. To have seen gay men, HIV negative and positive, to be complacent. And with PrEP, you know, the fact that so many people are coming forward and saying, I want this option to be able to stay safe from HIV, that doesn't speak to complacency. And the fact that huge numbers of people are now coming forward for testing, you know, something like a 35% increase in gay men seeking a HIV test through their GP in the last 3 or 4 years, that's not complacency. But stigma within our community and stigma more broadly, it's still a huge issue, and we can be really very tough on each other, and particularly be tough along the, you know, the zero divide. That, you know, it's really just completely overwhelming. So I'm not really sure what to expect in some ways, but the thing that I'm really excited about, I just actually sent out a message to our member organisations in the last couple of hours. There's some new data that's being announced now from the partner study ahead of the conference. And this data has tracked couples who are in, you know, serodiscordant relationships, one person HIV positive, one person HIV negative, gay and straight, has tracked people in relationships to see whether or not undetectable viral load, a person with HIV on treatment who has undetectable viral load, whether transmission actually occurs. And they were unable to find a single case. Wow. In an extraordinary number of couples having quite a lot of sex, couldn't find a single case of transmission occurring within these couples. 58,000 individual times these couples had sex without condoms, and the HIV positive partner had undetectable viral load. The HIV negative partner wasn't on PrEP. So treatment itself of a person with HIV, it's incredibly powerful as a prevention tool.
And that mirrors data that we've received from international studies as well.
It is. It's something that we've known for a couple of years now, but it so turns on its head all of the conventional understandings of HIV that, you know, that we've had as gay men and we've had through the epidemic. It's taking us time to wrap our heads around this. And you know, people with HIV have been calling for us to read the data. Yeah. NAPWA, the National Association, there has been really calling out for this. But the data is coming through very powerfully now that treatment is very effective in preventing HIV.
How do we get that across to the general general population, including the negative gay men, to try and alleviate some of their fears?
Well, I think this is part of the challenge, and you know, the HIV story is actually, you know, gay men have an extraordinarily sophisticated understanding, I think, of HIV, particularly gay men with who have HIV. You know, our knowledge is very deep, but you know, it is a complex story. It is a complex epidemic, and you know, even with the media over the last couple of days, as we talked about before, it's hard enough to convey the differences between HIV and AIDS, let alone provide a very, very detailed understanding to people in our communities about these sorts of issues. But that's our job, because this actually matters, and it matters to people with HIV who have always borne that that terrible burden of worrying about transmission, or feeling as though they are responsible for transmission, feeling as though they are held responsible for transmission. So we've got a duty as a community to undo some of the terrible damage that's been done through the epidemic and the divides that have been created in our community by understanding this kind of information.
Daryl, your final question before you head off to South Africa and to Durban. Is there a fear that this announcement, the end of AIDS, is going to somehow confuse people?
Look, I think there is a fear of that. I think there's a risk of that. And but you know, I suppose for me, Dean, the question is, what's the alternative? We have to update this story at some stage. We can't go on with people believing that the Grim Reaper, that the horror of the 80s is still the reality today. And you know, what makes this so stark for me is, you know, a person who is diagnosed today, the people that you talked about in the seroconverter report, people who have been diagnosed in the last 12 months, they shouldn't be facing the situation of talking to their parents, to their partner, to their children, to their friends, and having to, at the time when they're saying, I've just received a diagnosis, it's quite a serious thing, it's manageable, but, you know, it's a serious, it's a big deal. At the same time that they're doing that, they're having to educate that this isn't a death sentence, this isn't what it once was, and no, I'm not infectious, I'm not going to, you know, pass HIV on to you when I share this plate. It's not okay. We've got to update this story, and we've got to put the work into explaining this to the public so that we can take away some of the stigma that's surrounded the epidemic for so long.
CEO of the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations, Daryl O'Donnell, thank you for joining us on The Informer tonight.
Thanks so much, Dean.
Bill Botel is the Executive Director of the Pacific Friends of the Global Fund. Bill, you were an architect of the HIV response way back in the 80s, advising the government. This announcement that AIDS is no longer an issue here in Australia must be a good one for you personally.
Well, one never likes to, you know, be congratulatory when it comes to these things. I mean, the whole history of this has been a terrible tragedy for people who died and contracted the disease and had to deal with all the turbulence. But look, we can be quietly self-congratulatory, I guess, that all of the effort by so many people over 30 years has meant that AIDS, defining illnesses, are no longer a public health threat or emergency in Australia. And that's a tremendous achievement, given that in the early 1980s, when I was involved in things, and right up until the time we had antiretroviral therapy, 1,000 more people were dying every year, and there seemed to be no end in sight to that terrible death toll. So we can put AIDS in Australia off into history, but of course we've still got to concentrate now on what we do with HIV infection rates and what we do with AIDS and HIV in the world.
It's a little frustrating from my point of view that we have this vision of an end to HIV infections that is technically possible, but is it political will that is getting in the way of making that happen?
I think we have a great strategy, right? I think the strategic vision is there. And if we take antiretroviral therapies, that is people test and treat and go on to HIV treatment, we know they're less infectious, so that's great for them and great for the health budget. We know that with PrEP coming along for people who are HIV negative, who are at risk, that if they go onto PrEP, that really reduces chances of HIV infection, which is good for all concerned. And we are that much closer, I think, thanks to all these decades of scientific effort, to something that will be like a cure or a vaccine. And then there's behavioural questions as well. So I think we've got the right mix of technologies and strategies and mobilisation, but what we desperately need is the money and resources behind all of these things. I'm personally very apprehensive that we just accept some sort of normal levels of HIV infection and so on and so forth, and think that, well, we've done okay, but we don't need more, really. What's the problem? We've got a pill and things will be right. But the nature of this problem in the world is that viruses mutate. Things can get worse. If we were to take our foot off the accelerator, if you like, and just say, well, that's fine, no problem, I think over time we would come back with big problems of HIV infection rates and possible mutations and viruses and who knows, you know, sort of an increasing AIDS death toll.
We don't have to look too far to see that infection rates of HIV are at epidemic proportions, and many, many people are still dying of AIDS. We only have to go as far as New Guinea.
Oh, that's right. And in the world, I think about 40%, only 40% of people who are infected with HIV and who need to be on treatment are on treatment.
Mm.
So a lot of people in the world have untreated HIV infection, and a big proportion of those will go on to die of AIDS-related illnesses. However, in the last 10 years, both the HIV infection rate and the AIDS death rates have come down substantially around the world generally, but as you say, in Papua New Guinea, in Central Asia, and in some regions of the world where governments are either incompetent or not, or sometimes actively hostile to at-risk communities, then not surprisingly, you have a really serious problem.
And Russia is a boiling point at the moment.
Shocking. But the government in Russia is not just negligent; it actively goes after people on stigma, discrimination, on grounds of they're gay or rejecting drug users or sex workers or whatever, and they take every step that has made the situation far worse.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite incomprehensible, really.
It's a case study of what not to do, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yes. I mean, the one thing we know in Australia by trial and error, but at least by really trying to back radical and bold initiatives from the early days and working so closely with all the communities who are at risk, and the government's got out of the way of making this a political issue or trying to score political points. So right from the beginning of those 80s, right up till now, with Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten, Julie Bishop, I mean, the governments have tried to back what works, figure out what could be done better, what shouldn't be done, and we limited and, you know, the whole impact of the disease in Australia as much as we could. And several other countries in the world did that, in Europe. Other countries like America weren't as good at it. But we know what works, and we certainly know what doesn't work, what increases the risk of infection and therefore deaths and so on. Back what works and keep going on that, and we can look in time at an end to AIDS deaths in the world, but then HIV infection, and then hopefully in years to come to eliminating it altogether.
As Australia celebrates this achievement, no AIDS deaths, it is incumbent upon us to turn our attention to the rest of the world, and this is where your work with the Pacific Friends of the Global Fund comes into play. Tell us a little bit about what Pacific Friends is doing in the lead-up to the topping up of the fund itself.
Yes, well, every 3 years, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB and Malaria goes to the big donors in the world, the big countries, the Gates Foundation and so on, to say we need topping up to put pills in the mouths of people who need them in relation to AIDS, HIV, to TB and malaria. This year, the three-year replenishment comes up in Montreal in the middle of September. Prime Minister Trudeau will host that meeting. And we hope that this time around, the Global Fund will raise about $13 billion, and about a third of that will go to provision of HIV treatment to those who need it, which is a great thing. Australia, I hope, will increase its contribution. Presently, it's about $200 million per 3 years. It should be higher than that. So I think a very good outcome would be if Australia increased its contribution to $300 million over the 3 years, which is still only a very small proportion of the larger amount they'll raise, but it's better than nothing.
In fact, our government plateaued, did it not, in the last funding round?
It plateaued, yes. Yeah. It did, unfortunately. And this is regrettable, really. It has to be seen in the context of the policy of the previous government about overseas development assistance, where there were very, very substantial cuts in the budget for ODA generally, and that plays through to the global, the amount of money the government is able to provide for the global fund, as much as anything else. But I think it's a great return on investment. I mean, we know that if we get more people on treatment, there are fewer AIDS deaths, fewer HIV infections, and this really impacts places like Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, Myanmar, Vietnam, in our region. And many Australians come from those countries or travel to them. So that has to be a good thing.
Now,
it has to be a good thing.
Is the primary motivation philanthropy, or is it protecting our borders, so to speak?
Well, I think the primary motivation should be a good international citizen, obviously.
Sure.
If you really strip out from vulnerable countries problems related to health, problems related to sanitation, problems related to education, you know, and if you improve all of those things in fragile countries, those countries become more economically successful, the living standards improve, and over time things should become more peaceful. And we in Australia, like every other country in the world, would rather live in a region of peace and stability and growth and prosperity than living in a region where our next door neighbours were dying from preventable diseases or infected by diseases caused by poor sanitation, or where the education system was falling to pieces. It must be in the end in our interests for that to happen. Beyond that, it is the right thing to do. I mean, we live in an interdependent world, and the better the conditions of the poorest and most needy, in the end, the better it is for all of us.
Bill Bartel, when will we find out what Australia's commitment to the Global Fund is?
Australia will have to say something at the replenishment on the 16th of September in Montreal, and presumably between now and then, when the new Turnbull government is sworn in sometime in mid-July, the new Minister for Foreign Affairs, presumably Julie Bishop, but we must remain and see who will be appointed to that job, the government will have to make a decision between then and now about whether to increase the amount that it will give to the Global Fund. So we will be doing all we can, and we hope that people who are interested in this will also petition and write to the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister and just make the points that it would be great if Australia could increase its support for the Global Fund, and hopefully that will come. We'll have a good result when we get to the Montreal meeting.
Well, all the very best for that, and good luck with getting your Global Fund topped up. Executive Director of the Pacific Friends of the Global Fund, Bill Bartel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Dean.
And this weekend, AIDS 2016, the International AIDS Conference being held in Durban, South Africa, will explore the latest scientific and medical developments in HIV treatments and research, and look at the latest in HIV vaccine and cure. We wait with some anticipation as to what will be revealed. There'll be a podcast of today's edition of The Informer available for download later this evening at Joy's website, joy.org.au/The Informer. You can follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy, and you can follow me at Dean Beck on air. Till next time, keep well, take care. Bye for now.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.